The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Donald Trump is under the gun. If he wants to appeal the staggering verdict against him in New York civil fraud trial, he faces a March 25th deadline to post an appeal bond for $454 million for the verdict, plus 10% for interest. And New York Attorney General Letitia James has a take-no-prisoners approach.
If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek judgment enforcement mechanisms in court, and we will ask the judge to seize his assets.
The billionaire former president is running short on cash after losing two civil trials in less than 2 months, and he's trying to post a smaller $100 million bond or no bond at all. But the AG argues he must post the full bond because without that, Trump could attempt to avoid paying the fine if his appeal fails. Trump's legal debts put a spotlight on an obscure segment of the insurance market, the appeal bond. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Greg Farrell, who's written about it. Tell us why courts generally require either the cash or a bond if a person is going to appeal a civil judgment.
Simply put, courts do not want defendants, people on the losing end of a civil judgment, to basically appeal because they can kick the can down the road, buy time to dispose of assets. Otherwise, in the case of contractors where surety bonds are often used, what if the guy goes bust? You want the money there in case something happens. In Trump's case, it wasn't so much going bust as much as it's applicable because there are people like him who just will keep appealing just to, put off the day of judgment.
An appeal bond is like a surety bond. Explain more about it.
Yes, it's an insurance product. It's a guarantee. Basically, it's almost like a lockbox. You get a surety company, which is separate. There are some surety agencies, but most of them are affiliated with big global insurance firms. And they will have underwriters who have to be satisfied that the money is there and that it's accessible to them, that they have a priority on it. And then they will write the bond so that the court can, hold the bond. The court does not want to hold cash, so that the bond will be there at the point in time when an appeals court upholds the judgment, if that's the case.
And a losing party could put up cash.
Yes. In fact, that's the easiest way to do it. It's that the court itself, this is why it becomes a surety bond, doesn't want to become a bank and hold large amounts of cash around. So it's a cost to the defendant, in this case Trump, to actually have to A, get the money, B, 110% of the money, and that number will grow if this appeal goes months and months or more than a year or something, that number could become larger. And, basically, as the plaintiff's lawyer quoted at the end of the story, it's in the cash register. So once the final judgment from the appeals court, the circuit comes down, it's like, ka-ching, open up the cash register and take it out.
So the interest keeps accruing even once he pays the bond?
Yes. And that's why you have to put up 110%, because you're not only securing today's judgment, but it's going to be months or longer before the circuit court is after. So you have to put in extra for that amount so that you don't just have the bond of the judgment today. But meanwhile, a year from now, when the verdict comes down, that money which the winner should have had in their possession and would have grown in interest, they're deprived of that. As the case I pointed to at the bottom of the story about Lynn Tilton is that the original judgment, I think, was for $38 million, but over the course of time, I think it took well over a year, maybe 2 years, that it swelled to $51 million. So the surety bond, there's a projection that, if this takes 2 years for the appellate court to get around to this, that the money will grow. There'll be enough to cover a 10% rate for 2 years, which is a real number.
For the first E. Jean Carroll verdict,
$5 million.
Trump gave the cash, plus 10%. But now Trump has gotten a bond to cover the E. Jean Carroll verdict of $83.3 million.
The defamation one, which was much more expensive for him. That's right. Ironically, the trial about whether or not he assaulted her resulted in a $5 million penalty. But this one, for defaming her, was a much larger verdict, and he's contesting that. So that's 83 plus 8.3 million, which is like 10% of it, which is where you get to, like, I guess, 91.6.
Trump used the federal insurance company, an arm of the insurance giant Chubb, to post the bond. Do we know anything else about it, like the collateral he put up?
Unfortunately, no, and we'd love to know about it. And even more importantly, here's the key. Trump's a billionaire, and he points to all his real estate assets and other things in his statements of financial condition to support the notion that he's a billionaire several times over. But what we don't know is whether all these buildings like 40 Wall Street and some of these other trophy properties, are they owned free and clear, or are they encumbered with other loans and mortgages that are in the public eye? So that's one of the real interesting points here for us on the outside, is Chubb obviously became satisfied that, you know, they would be made whole no matter what. So either he put up some cash for that or something that was as good as cash. But I think in this much larger bond, that's the next one, which is going to have to be like close to $500 million, namely $450, the judgment that Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, won, that judgment plus 10%, another 45. So you're getting close to $500 million. Trump does not have that kind of cash around. You know, he talked about having $400 million around, but he's probably used some of that already. And he needs to keep cash around to run his businesses. So now we're in a place where he has to either rely on an angel investor of some kind, you know, an Elon Musk-type character who's willing to put up some money for him, or some kind of a collateral using his property, either selling some of his buildings and real estate assets or allowing a surety bond company to take a priority interest in one or more pieces of real estate so that they'll be made whole if Trump were to lose on that appeal. So this is going to be a much more serious one. And yes, the key point is we don't know, that we got no insight last Friday as to where this money came from, whether it was cash or whether it was a pledge of property. And for the bigger one, we probably won't know either. The only thing we would find out, I would imagine, is once the appellate courts decide, and if they decide against Trump, and then he has to put, you know, 40 Wall Street up for sale, then we'll know from the outside that he had pledged, you know, a particular building as collateral, and therefore the people who underwrote the surety bond have to go execute on that and, you know, force a sale of some of his buildings.
And the surety company gets money up front, right? A percentage.
Right. So they get a premium. Basically, in general, it's 2%. So Chubb Insurance, which wrote the surety bond or underwrote the surety bond for Trump, get 2%, or about $1.8 million just as a fee to do this. So, right, unlike other insurance products, you know, they plan on no losses. They're not built around losses. That's why they're kind of an odd duck as an insurance product line, because it is a form of insurance, but they write to a 0% loss target, you know, that there's always going to be money there to cover them. So that's why surety bonds were the unwanted redheaded stepchild of the insurance industry. But in the past decade, as the insurance industry, the property and casualty insurance industry, has undergone some difficult times with a whole series of natural disasters and investments that have not panned out in the markets, that this has become something that attractive to them. They're a profit center. Surety bonds make money from day one. They don't lose money the way property and casualty insurance policies are designed to do.
You spoke to a lawyer, Scott Horton, who said it's very difficult to see a financial institution agreeing to post a bond in the amount necessary here. But Trump has all that real estate. I mean,
yes, but here's another problem. Trump does have some relationships with banks. I think the Deutsche Bank loans have been either paid off or transferred, so Deutsche Bank is no longer the bank it used to be for Trump. But there are other lenders. However, Trump can't just go and get $500 million elsewhere when he already has some kind of a debt or a loan obligation to the bank. So he has to get some kind of a waiver from his existing banks to allow him to go take on other debt to pay this off, or else use those banks. And then those banks have to become comfortable with, okay, if he loses this, if the judgment goes against him and it's going to be $500 million, we need to be able to get a priority position on selling the real estate or wherever it is it's going to come from.
Trump has made an emergency request to stop enforcement of the verdict in the New York fraud case that was denied by an appeals court judge. It will be decided by a full appellate panel. He's also proposing posting a smaller $100 million bond, but the AG is not having any of it.
Right. So that'll be up to the judge to decide. But in the real world in which we live, this is a huge appeal bond Trump's going to have to, you know, come up with in order to appeal this verdict. And the AG forcefully, as you pointed out, responded that no, he should be obliged to obey the law or the rules like everyone else and put up, you know, the full amount plus 10%. Trump's goal here is to convince the judge in this matter that, you know, that amount would force him to basically sell properties at a fire sale price, you know, so that he'd have to take a loss. And then in the case that he actually wins the appeal, then you can't just go back and buy it back for the same amount you sold it for. It's like you've basically forced losses well above the norm on this. So that's the current state of play on Trump's bond. He's trying to get it lowered to a $100 million, much more manageable amount than the larger one. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. This is going to fold over the next few weeks, is whether or not Trump will get some relief and be able to just post a smaller amount if he gets judicial approval, or if he has to come up with $500 million, that will be interesting to see where he comes up with it and who provides it. Because if it is some deep-pocketed person, we will not know that necessarily within a month if this happens. It would only be if he loses his appeal that we'll get some indication as to where, you know, the funds come from.
Because the AG says she doesn't believe that he has to sell properties at a loss in order to secure the bond, and she wants proof that surety companies refuse to accept. She loves 40 Wall Street, the skyscraper, as collateral.
First of all, that is a great property. It's got to be worth well more than enough to cover this. But yes, Trump makes lots of claims. In fact, just last week he wanted to delay this particular bond that he delivered on Friday, and the judge ruled against him, saying, no, you've had like a month to do this, and only now you're showing up at the end saying you don't have enough time. You've had plenty of time. And, of course, when you looked at the bond, it had been struck on March 5th, more than a week ago. So it's just, you know, Trump's very consistent when he's dealing with legal issues in putting things off. Never, you know, speed it up and get it over with. Always kick the can down the road, delay this, drag this out. And it's been successful for him. But I think James brings up a fair point here. If no one's going to write it, just show us, you know, what the surety agency, prove your claim to us. In other words, don't just talk, but actually show some evidence supporting your position that you need more time or it needs to be lowered. The issue is this, though. If he loses the appeal, then the state of New York is going to have to chase him down for years, especially if he's president. You know, by then, they won't be able to get it. So I think there's a legitimate point on the state of New York, having won this judgment, that, no, we want it in a lockbox that we can have access to instead of trying to chase it down. Because, yes, if he's president, you know, come and get it, you know.
I mean, can you imagine how difficult that would be? Thanks so much, Greg. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Greg Farrell. Coming up next, how Mitch McConnell stacked the courts. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Judicial nominations don't usually get much attention unless they're at the Supreme Court level. But the importance of circuit court nominees can't be overstated. Just look at the ultra-conservative Fifth Circuit, with 12 judges appointed by Republicans, including six named by former President Donald Trump, and only four appointed by Democrats. The circuit has limited access to a commonly used abortion pill, tossed out the federal ban on bump stocks, and said people subject to a domestic violence restraining order still have the constitutional right to carry a gun. Just a few of the far-reaching, almost impossible to ignore, Fifth Circuit rulings that the Supreme Court has taken up this term. And it was then-Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell, of one-third of the Federal Appeals Court bench during Trump's presidency. Joining me is an expert on the federal judiciary, Carl Tobias, a professor at the University of Richmond School of Law. Before we turn to Mitch McConnell's influence, Carl, let's talk about Biden's nominees. The Judiciary Committee advanced a slate of nominees, which will bring unprecedented diversity to trial courts in D.C., Rhode Island, and Virginia. And most of those nominees got bipartisan support?
Yes. And so that's very positive. And those are really well-qualified mainstream nominees, so they will be terrific. And they'll make history in Rhode Island and Western District of Virginia and the District of Columbia District Court.
Are things changing on the Judiciary Committee that you're getting, you know, 4 out of 5 bipartisan support?
Well, I think Lindsey Graham is critical to that. He's the ranking member from South Carolina, and he believes that everyone on his side of the aisle should defer when they are acceptable nominees from this White House, and has urged his colleagues on the committee and in the caucus to work with the White House. And a lot of these recent nominees, there were 5 at one hearing, all were red state nominees supported by 2 home state GOP senators. And so that's very encouraging. But he often will vote, and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and others have joined in, and especially those in the red states who have recommended the nominees, and then they have gone on through the process very smoothly.
Where does this put Biden as far as, you know, what I call the race for judicial nominees? I mean, where does it put him at this point?
Well, he now is ahead of the same point in 2020 with Trump's numbers on the district level. So after this week, I think there'll be 5 more district nominees who will be confirmed. And Trump had 138 at this point. If Biden succeeds in having the 5 confirmed this week, he will have 144. The difference is in the appellate ones, where at this point in 2020, Trump had 51 appellate, and Biden has 40 appellate confirmations, but 3 are on the floor waiting votes, and 1 needs a hearing. So that's where we are, and we'll see. There are close to 10 appellate vacancies, and some of those don't have nominees, but I'm cautiously optimistic that those could be filled. And so it could be quite close, and I think it's pretty clear now that Biden will eclipse the number of district nominees confirmed. It's more difficult at the appellate level.
Now, how much can we credit Mitch McConnell with Trump's level of appointees?
Substantially. Remember back in 2015-16, at the end of Obama's second term, the Republicans in 2014 captured a majority in the Senate, and they only confirmed 2 appellate nominees Obama's last 2 years, and 1 was for the Federal Circuit, and only 18, I think, district judges. So that left an enormous number of vacancies, over 100, but especially at the appellate level for Trump to fill, which he did quite vigorously, especially in the appeals courts. It's been a long time since anyone's confirmed 54 appellate nominees in the first term of a presidency.
So Mitch McConnell, it seems like his driving goal in his career has been to stack the courts with conservatives. Was he stacking them with conservatives, or was he stacking them with white male conservatives?
Well, that's a good question. I think most of them turned out to be white males, but there were many conservatives who were also people of color. There were some. I'm thinking of Naomi Rao on the D.C. Circuit and Jim Ho on the Fifth Circuit and a number of others. But I think principally you're correct if you were to look through. And there were no black nominees for the appeals court from Trump in his entire tenure, which is a very telling contrast with Biden.
So can we credit, or should we credit, Mitch McConnell with 2 Trump appointees to the Supreme Court?
No, we credit him with 3.
With 3. Okay. I thought 1 was the retirement of Justice Kennedy, so we didn't count that.
Well, you'll remember back to 2016, Merrick Garland was Obama's nominee for Justice Scalia's vacancy, and McConnell refused to process his nomination, and so held that seat, and basically Democrats think that he stole that seat, which by rights and tradition should have been one that Obama filled. and Merrick Garland was a well-qualified mainstream nominee for the Supreme Court. But remember then when Justice Ginsburg unfortunately died in the fall of 2020, then McConnell rushed through Amy Coney Barrett to be confirmed a week before Biden defeated Trump for the presidency. So on either end there, he wasn't consistent in his treatment, but succeeded in confirming three. And of course, in the middle was Justice Kavanaugh for the Kennedy seat.
McConnell stepping down as leader, but he said if the Republicans won control of the Senate, they would not advance any Supreme Court nominees of a Democratic president. Have we gotten to that point, or now that he's out of leadership, do you think we go back to confirming nominees the way they used to be confirmed, no matter who's the president?
Perhaps. I think when they're at the Supreme Court level, all bets are really off at this point. Even at the lower courts, remember, there's been a lot of lockstep voting against Biden nominees. But to some extent, Democrats reflected something similar, though not as overwhelming during the Trump years, especially as to the appellate nominees who Democrats opposed, especially once they saw what the nominees look like over time and what McConnell was doing so successfully at the appellate level, which of course is where 99% of cases ultimately are decided because the Supreme Court hears so few.
Is there anyone ready to take his place in this arena?
Well, the names, of course, are the three Johns, and the two leaders seem to be Cornyn and Thune. And I think they're not quite as rigid as McConnell was on these issues, and they haven't either one made a name for themselves. But I think they have voted with the party on especially Supreme Court nominees and appellate nominees as well. And Cornyn has been on Judiciary, senior member of that committee, and speaks with some authority, but also works quite, I think, well with the White House on lower courts, especially in Texas. And I don't think Thune, has much expertise or interest in the judiciary, though there are two nominees from South Dakota who he has recommended, and they're going to easily be confirmed. But I don't think there is that kind of ruthlessness, if you will, that McConnell exhibited that either of the two frontrunners is likely to subscribe to. So we'll see. But it may be, again, all the Supreme Court vacancies are sui generis in terms of how the processes play out.
Let's just turn to something that I just found interesting, which is that administrative employees of the federal judiciary are now allowed once again to engage in political activities outside of work. A Trump administration rule had stopped them from doing that?
It's 1,100 or so employees, I think mostly administrative offices of the U.S. courts. And I think the feeling was in the Trump administration that public employees in the courts shouldn't participate too actively in politics. But I don't think anybody's worried that those 1,100 employees are going to make a difference in a particular race. But, of course, judges cannot be involved at all in anything political. All of them are not, under the canons and just practice. And so I'm not too worried that these court employees, will upset anyone. But, we're worried about the appearance in 28 U.S.C. 455 about conflicts of interest. But I think this is fine, and I don't expect a lot of political activity, but it's nice that they are, allowed to participate.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Carl. That's Professor Carl Tobias of the University of Richmond Law School. And in other legal news today,
we did not, however, identify evidence that rose to the level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Because the evidence fell short of that standard, I declined to recommend criminal charges against Mr. Biden.
Special Counsel Robert Hur testified for more than 4 hours before the House Judiciary Committee today, steadfastly standing by his decision not to charge President Joe Biden over his handling of classified documents and his statements about the president's memory that outraged Democrats.
I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the attorney general my decision and the reasons for it. That's what I was required to do.
Her had characterized the president as a, quote, sympathetic, well-meaning, elderly man with a poor memory, and Democrats took issue with that. California Congressman Adam Schiff said that language should not have been included.
That is nowhere in the rules. I was to prepare a confidential report that was comprehensive and thorough of an
explanation. What is in the rules, Mr. Herr, what is in the rules is you don't gratuitously do things to prejudice the subject of an investigation when you're declining to prosecute. You don't gratuitously add language that you know will be useful in a political campaign. You were not born yesterday. You understood exactly what you were doing.
The hearing comes at a time when the White House is confronting questions about Biden's age, which polls show as one of his biggest liabilities heading into the November election. Coming up next, if you know about financial misconduct, overseas bribery, or other corporate fraud, you could get a reward for providing that information to the Justice Department. That's coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
If you know about financial misconduct, overseas bribery, or other corporate fraud, you could get a reward for tipping off the Justice Department. DOJ has announced it will start paying whistleblowers who help the department discover significant corporate or financial misconduct. It's the latest in the Biden administration's white-collar enforcement policy shift designed to entice more self-reporting of corporate wrongdoing. Joining me is Nicole Ingish, a former federal prosecutor and Minnesota state judge, and now a partner at Dorsey & Whitney. What do we know about this program at this point?
So what we know is that the Department of Justice is, within the next 90 days, going to be doing what they call a 90-day sprint to gather information to implement a new whistleblower reward program. So the Department of Justice is going to be studying existing programs, looking at those as models for its own, and then by the end of the year, it's going to be implementing a program that should be rewarding whistleblowers who alert prosecutors to significant corporate misconduct.
I mean, is this really necessary? There are so many whistleblower programs out there.
Right. The Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monica, noted that the purpose of this particular program is to fill in the gap. So basically, she described sort of a patchwork quilt that is on the bed that's only covering part of the bed. So the existing programs have gaps that this program is expected to fill. For example, the Securities and Exchange Commission has a program, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission has a whistleblower program, and the False Claims Act has a QI-TAM whistleblower statutory scheme, but each of these is necessarily limited jurisdictionally and otherwise to more narrow scopes. The Department of Justice's new whistleblower program is going to be much broader because the mission of the Department of Justice is much broader.
Are there specific areas that, you know, that they want whistleblowers to come forward in?
Yes, the Department of Justice has a broad mission covering, you know, all federal crimes, but the Deputy Attorney General is going to be particularly interested in those complaints that relate to abuses of the U.S. financial system, corruption cases. So this would include foreign corruption cases that are outside the jurisdiction of the SEC, also domestic corruption cases, and that would be especially those cases that involve corporate payments to government officials. The Department of Justice is also looking in particular at cases that would be brought under the very newly enacted Foreign Extortion Prevention Act, which is going to target foreign officials on the demand side of foreign bribery cases.
How necessary do you think this program is? And could it sort of overwhelm the resources of the Justice Department?
Well, the purpose of it is to kind of go hand in glove with the existing corporate criminal enforcement policies to sort of encourage and foster a climate of compliance. And so the idea is to, you know, follow along with some of these existing policies that the Deputy Attorney General and Attorney General Merrick Garland have been implementing in recent years to really encourage corporations, for example, to voluntarily self-disclose their own criminal misconduct or to identify culpable individuals. If they're not doing so, then the point of this whistleblower program is to ensure that if the corporations don't voluntarily self-disclose, there's going to be a financial incentive for those who might know of the misconduct to disclose, all of which the goal, at least, is to encourage that overall, you know, compliance culture.
It seems to take a lot of effort at the SEC to go through these whistleblower complaints, you know, to check them out, follow up, bring cases. Does the Justice Department intend to put enough people into this to make it work?
It remains to be seen the details that are going to, you know, be a part of this program and exactly who's going to be involved. We do know that it's going to be the money laundering and asset recovery section that's going to take a leading role in basically designing and coming up with the specifics, both for the pilot and then for the program as a whole. So it would seem that the department is going to make the investment in this. But the important thing is that because the funds that will be used to pay for it, to pay whistleblowers the reward, are monies coming out of asset forfeiture, there already will be an existing source for the funds for the whistleblower payments.
The administration has also asked in the past for corporations to hand over evidence they uncover of internal misconduct.
That's exactly right, especially in recent years, again, with Attorney General Merrick Garland and this Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco. They've really been kind of emphasizing a carrot and sticks approach to corporate enforcement and really trying to incentivize corporations to voluntarily self-disclose. And this program is to fit right within that. And so the idea is it should add pressure on corporations to self-report and to do so promptly before a whistleblower does so.
Has the Biden administration then, have they upped enforcement of white-collar crime?
The enforcement of white-collar crime has been going down every year since, I think, a height of it in 2011. There's some independent organizations that have done assessments, some of which the department disagrees with, but overall, the prosecution of white-collar crime has been going down. So part of the goal behind this program is to increase the cases that will find their way to the Department of Justice, not only the number, but probably the breadth of criminal cases that the Department of Justice will be able to prosecute in the white-collar area. And that's because white-collar criminal cases are notoriously difficult to detect and difficult to bring. Typically, you do need someone on the inside who can tell the government what's going on and who can alert the government to the alleged crime. And so there's no doubt this program is intended to potentially increase the number of white-collar cases that the department can prosecute.
And is it clear that the department has the authority to implement this?
Yes. In fact, the department has the authority and has had the authority for some time statutorily to pay monetary awards to individuals who provide information or assistance that leads to civil or criminal forfeitures, but this is the first time the Department of Justice is actually creating an official program to do so, to award whistleblowers. But it certainly has the statutory authority to do that, and that comes under Title 28 of the United States Code.
Is there any problem you see with this program? I know it's in the preliminary stages, but do you see any problems?
There are some, you know, requirements and therefore some limitations on this that also create some challenges. For example, the whistleblower under this program will have to present information that the prosecutors, and that's prosecutors in any office across the country, don't already know. So a whistleblower may or may not know in advance whether they are presenting information the department is aware of or not. The whistleblower also has to be the first in the door to get any kind of benefits, and again, may not know if someone else beat them to the door. The whistleblower will not be permitted to have engaged in any of the wrongdoing or have been involved in the underlying criminal activity. The whistleblower can't have any existing financial disclosure obligation or incentive, including under a QITAM action that might be available or from any of the other federal whistleblower programs. And any payments to whistleblowers will only be made after all victims have been compensated. So all of those requirements create challenges. In addition, it is typically a process that can take a long time, which may disincentivize other would-be whistleblowers from coming forward. And because we're talking about criminal cases, it's unlikely that whistleblowers in this program will be able to remain anonymous, which they are able to be in the SEC and the CFTC process through a central whistleblower office. It's unlikely here because typically criminal cases result in discovery through the criminal case process, meaning the defendant is going to be entitled to know who is raising issues and who brought the issue to the attention of the government. Not always, but in most instances. So I think it's likely that whistleblowers in this program can't be anonymous. Their credibility is likely to be subject to being attacked as part of the criminal case. And there's also a risk that a whistleblower comes forward and that a defendant may point, you know, the finger to the whistleblower and say that person is actually the culpable person. And if they prevail, not only could the whistleblower be prosecuted, but they won't be entitled to get any recovery of funds. And not only are some of these things that I've mentioned, you know, unique challenges, but other programs don't necessarily have these same requirements. As mentioned, the SEC and the CFTC does allow for anonymous and confidential complaints. And, for example, the False Claims Act will allow someone, a whistleblower, to recover at least part of an award, even if they have some culpability. So those are some of the main challenges that this new program appears to be imposing.
Well, we'll find out more in about 90 days, I guess. Thanks so much for being on the show, Nicole. That's Nicole English, a partner at Dorsey & Whitney, and a former federal prosecutor and Minnesota State Court judge. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.